Good morning, and welcome to the March 3rd, 2021 meeting of the Education Finance Committee. Remote hearings such as this are held in accordance with House Rule 10.01. This rule has been posted online and is linked to in our public meeting notice on the House website. All remote hearings will be recorded and live streamed by House Public Information Service. Members have the contents of their virtual packets available to them. And for the public, these same materials have been posted online. Members, if you're looking for all the items in one place, they're attached to the calendar event you have that Ms. Burt sent for today. To get on the list to be recognized by the chair, members using the Zoom interface have the ability to raise their hand via the app. Ms. Burt will place your name on the list to be recognized. Ms. Sunderland, would you please call the roll?
Chair Dabney.
Present.
Vice Chair Sandsted.
Present.
Representative Kreisha.
Present.
Representative Bennett.
Present.
Representative Daniels.
Present.
Representative Damath.
Damath present.
Representative Drazkowski.
Present.
Representative Erickson.
Present.
Representative Feist.
Present.
Representative Jordan.
Present.
Representative Marquardt.
Present.
Representative Mueller.
Present.
Perfect. Representative Richardson.
Present.
Representative Thompson. Representative Thompson. I saw him earlier on the call. We'll check back there.
I see him now.
Okay. Representative Thompson? Representative Wolgamott?
Wolgamott, present.
Representative Zhang?
Present.
Representative Joachim?
Present.
And we'll try one last time to get him on voice vote. Representative Thompson, are you there?
Looks like he's got a busy family.
Perfect. We'll mark him as here. We saw him there. That is the roll, and we do have a quorum.
Fabulous. Thank you, Ms. Sunderland. Representative Sandsted, have you had the opportunity to review the minutes from our Tuesday, March 2nd meeting? And if so, would you move approval?
I did, Mr. Chair, and I so move the minutes from March 2nd.
Thank you very much. Any discussion to the Sandsted motion? Hearing none, all those in favor of the Sandsted motion approving the minutes from Tuesday, March 2nd, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Sandsted. Today, in committee members, we'll be sending House File 486 to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee, and we'll have what I'm hoping will be a spirited discussion about evidence-based practices within education grant making when we discuss and lay over House File 1057. We'll also be hearing from a researcher at the University of Minnesota who directs a center that's focused on evidence-based research practices. Members, on to House File 486. Our intention is to take action on this bill by 10:55 a.m. this morning. Representative Feist, would you like to make a motion to move House File 486 before the committee with the recommendation we refer to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I would move that House File 486 be before this committee and move to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Feist, I understand you have an author's amendment. Would you like to move the A1 before the committee to get the bill into the shape you'd like?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move the A1 amendment.
Thank you very much. Would you like to briefly describe the A1 author's amendment, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The Department of Health and the Department of Education jointly reached out to me and requested that this funding be directed to the Department of Health rather than the Department of Education because they have the expertise and administer it, and it's just easier for them rather than executing an interagency agreement to administer the program.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Feist. Any discussion to the A1 amendment and Representative Feist's motion? Seeing none, all those in favor of the author's motion to get the bill in the form that she prefers, please signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Feist, you may proceed with introducing House File 486 as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In 2016, the Minnesota Department of Health and Minnesota Department of Education, in collaboration with NAMI Minnesota, piloted the Cognito Suicide Prevention Training in Minnesota. This program offers a series of online professional development modules designed for schools to increase educators' and school staff's skills, confidence, and willingness to intervene with students in distress. It includes three online interactive courses, each targeted to school staff working with a specific age group, elementary, grades K-5, middle years, grades 6-8, and high school, grades 9-12. There was a very positive response to the training. Teachers and principals felt that it was thorough, easy to use, and increase their confidence in supporting students. In 2019, the legislature authorized funding to make this suicide prevention training available across the state. The program was launched in May of 2020. Feedback to date has been very good, with teachers and staff ranking it high, with 95% saying that it presented scenarios that are relevant to their experience. There have been 75 schools, districts, charter schools, private schools, and tribal schools participating, and so far, 4,885 teachers and staff have activated their account, and 4,054 have completed the training. It satisfies the one-hour requirement for suicide prevention training for educators, as determined by the district, so there is also an incentive for schools to offer this to their teachers. At a time when we know our students are struggling with their mental health, it is important now more than ever to provide the best training possible on suicide prevention. Therefore, I urge the committee's support. And I'm excited to have mental health experts as well as a teacher who has undergone this training here to testify today.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Feist. I have a list of three individuals who have signed up to testify. First on the list is Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of the National Alliance for Mental Illness Minnesota. Ms. Abderholden, welcome back to the committee. Good to see you. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Member Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. Just briefly, because of time, I just want to say that this truly is the best suicide prevention training that we can provide to our teachers. NAMI actually offers QPR, Question, Persuade, and Refer, which is a one-hour suicide prevention training. It is evidence-based, and we've been delivering it to, you know, thousands of teachers every year. We think this is better. It has scenarios. It has those little avatars, so you kind of look like real people that you're talking with, and it really helps teachers know what to say and have a reaction to it. So I'm going to let the others testify, and I'm here for questions. But again, we are very concerned about the mental health of our students going into the future as they return to school and after they've experienced, frankly, great trauma because of the pandemic, George Floyd's death, and other incidents. And so we want to make sure that teachers have the best training possible to make sure that we, frankly, keep our students safe. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. Next on my list is Stephanie Downey, Suicide Prevention Coordinator with the Minnesota Department of Health. Ms. Downey, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Stephanie Downey, Suicide Prevention Coordinator with the Minnesota Department of Health. And today I have some data that I wanted to share with you. So I'm going to share my screen. We'll hope that this goes off without a hitch.
Good luck.
So is everybody seeing that? Okay.
Yes.
As I mentioned, good morning, Mr. Chair and everyone. I'm Stephanie Downey. I am a suicide prevention coordinator with the Minnesota Department of Health. And the following slides are a brief summary of the online school mental health awareness training. So this map shows the counties where there have been activations so far of the Cognito at-risk for educators training sessions across the state. As you can see from the map, there are also areas in the state where school staff have not yet taken advantage of the training opportunity. The training sessions are available statewide to all public, charter, tribal, and private schools, as Representative Feist mentioned. You can also see the activations to date now have went up. We have 5,665. So every day we increase that number. This map or graph shows the usage of each different Cognita at-risk training simulation, the elementary, the middle, and the high school. All three training sessions are virtually accessible to the participant. As you can see from the graph, there have been more school staff participation with the elementary and the high school training sessions. So there appears to be a gap with the middle school staff taking the training session, which is an area that provides us opportunity and growth. The training sessions are available for all school staff, including but not limited to teachers, administrative staff, paraprofessionals, food service staff, maintenance staff, transportation staff. So providing training like this to all staff increases the number of adults within school settings that are gaining skills to support student wellness and school safety. Participants are asked after they complete the training to complete a survey, and 99% have rated the training good to very good to excellent. And as was mentioned, 95% felt that it was very relevant to their school experience. 95% would recommend it to others. And this training of this nature provides a common language, knowledge, tools, and consistency for all staff that are working within a school. So additional funding support could bring opportunities for pre-K, pre-kindergarten educators, and student populations, which would provide students the opportunity to learn how to talk to and identify a friend or a classmate who might be struggling. College and university settings, trauma-informed schools, and or postvention training, which references the support and response after a suicide death or other traumatic death. So I thank you very much for your time and listening to this data summary.
Thank you, Ms. Downing. Last on the list of testifiers who've asked to be recognized is Daniel Devine, an art teacher at Pequot Lakes High School. Mr. Devine, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hello, Dan Devine. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, representatives. I teach at Pequot Lakes visual arts, 5th through 12th grade, so I see a range of development there. I'm a husband of five boys, and we also take in kids at risk out of the, what we can with foster care as we do that through the county. So I come in a couple different hats here, and I just want to first off say I feel like this is a no-brainer to put money towards. I've been a part of a number of trainings, and you get a lot of sit and talk at moments about suicide prevention, but this has been the first one that I've ever had where you actually interact with it. And I think that was one of my for sure takeaways, is scoring this as one of the top trainings that I've ever been a part of. I feel it's very important that we empower teachers to know how to prevent suicide and just mainly come up again with that language or be bold enough to address it when you see it. So other things that I found myself within the interactive scenarios, knowing that I was in a safe environment, I could try things. We had our school, specifically K through 12, all take it. Our paras are being presented with it right now. And I like, I guess, the direction that this could go with even students. I think just empowering them as well with, again, voiced and what to say. I think we all know it. Our students are struggling. I see it on a day-to-day basis. And it's everybody's very fragile right now. And it could be the simplest thing of a redirect of, and it's simple, right? Like maybe just don't sit there, or maybe you two students need to separate. But there's a lot of underlying things that are happening here as we're all trying to navigate this, as whether it's getting back into school, seeing proximity level of kids closer together, and that friction is definitely being played out. And so I think, yeah, it's important for us as teachers to be up on the top of our game right now, more than ever. And again, this training can help with that and what that can be for, again, giving us tools. I think I've always had the tools, but as good reminders of just, you know, being a good listener, taking that time about the relationship with the kid, and really just showing empathy, I think, in a moment where, again, all of us are either stuck behind a mask trying to navigate this world and what this can look like moving forward. And I know our students are really trying to process that too. So, yeah, please continue to provide funding, guys. This is a training that can really reach a lot of different places. And like I said, can move in some really sweet directions. I just personally, since the training, whether it's with my own kind of child in our home that we've been fostering over a year and a half now, it comes from a lot of trauma, a lot of crazy background, moving around. And with that, he has constant navigating moments where he'll get in some dark places and say, I want to kill myself. I'm done with this. And after this training, I felt like I've been able to be a little more bold and kind of say, well, what does that look like? You know, how, you know, I'm going to ask the question, like, how would you kill yourself? You know, and I don't think I would have had that language before this training, really, knowing that I think it's a healthy thing to actually talk it through and process with the child and know that maybe it is just maybe a statement, you know, more than an actual action that would transpire. But knowing that if it is something that that's been premeditative, yeah, how do we then continue to rally the support and bring others into these child's lives? And there again, yeah, even from another student that I've had in class, we're, yeah, having a hard time with just navigating school and in tears, really, you know, and just, but being able to, again, be a good listener, come along, just have some empathy and take that time a day with them. And I hate to say it, but sometimes, you know, you get in that grind of life and you just kind of keep passing the kids off and just say, oh, go on to the next one. You'll figure it out with that next teacher. But can't do that. I think we got to step up to the plate more and more. And again, that training's been able to help me support a lot of where I believe I went into education for that, you know, to help the kids and grow the kids and be there for the kids. So this is my 12th year teaching. still want to continue to be a positive voice in kids' lives. And I think this training's heading in, like I said, the right direction. So continue to provide funding and thanks for your time.
Gorgeous work, Mr. Devine. Thank you very much for that. Mr. Devine, excuse me. Public testimony. Members, when this hearing was posted, the public was provided with instruction on how to sign up to testify during the public portion of this bill hearing. We received no requests from the public to testify. Questions from members? Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks to the author of the bill and the testifiers. Mr. Chair, members, we are in a situation now where the biggest contributor of suicide among kids is the governor's imposed shutdown on the state of Minnesota and our schools. For the majority of the members on this committee having voted 13 times not to lift the governor's emergency powers and take this impediment, this causation of suicide among our kids off of their shoulders, and then bring a bill to spend money to somehow help suicide prevention when the known causation is still there. And the resistance to voting to lift that causation, members, some of you want to have your foot on the brake and the gas pedal at the same time. All that's going to do is smoke the tires, and there's not going to be any progress forward. It's time to lift this causation of suicide off of Minnesota's kids before we enact something like this. I'm voting no on the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Drazkowski. Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just think I wanted to first thank Representative Feist for bringing forward this bill. What I want to make very clear, and I'm not an expert, so I'll ask a question of the expert too, is we had a mental health crisis with our children before COVID. We had it during COVID, and we'll have it after COVID. And maybe Ms. Abner Holden can shed some light on some of the statistics that we saw in mental health among our children, mental health crises among our children before COVID. I know a little bit about this as we had a very large hearing on adverse childhood experiences in our ed policy group and our education policy committee the last 2 years read a book around adverse childhood experiences as well. But I like to listen to the experts. So Ms. Abner Holden, I hate to put you on the spot, but but I know you're great with stats. So could you maybe illuminate us all a little bit?
Ms. Abderholden, this is not the first time that you've been before this committee with concerns about student mental health. In fact, I was speaking to a leader in the private school sector just this morning who was discussing with me the challenges that they've been seeing over many years in student mental health. Can you help us?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members. So suicide among youth has been an increasing problem. I mean, I've been at NAMI almost 20 years. It's been an issue since the beginning, usually kind of depending, you know, the second or third cause of death among young people up to about age 21. You know, we came to the legislature several years ago requiring teachers to have a 1 hour continuing education on suicide prevention for this very reason. And so, you know, when this bill passed, obviously, in 2019, before we had the pandemic. So this is continuing this effort to make sure that we are keeping our students safe, that teachers know what those warning signs are, and that they know how to address it if a student comes forward to them.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. Representative Joachim, anything in a follow-up?
No, I just want to say thank you, and I wish we could do more for the training than just 1 hour. I know my husband and my son and the four other teachers in our family have participated in this training, and they would like to see a lot more tools in the toolbox and working with kids. So I think this is a great start, but we have a longer conversation to have. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question for Mr. Strom. Local district staff development dollars be, they could use this to pay for this funding, pay for this training, is that correct?
Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kreisha, perhaps best to talk with the Department of Health about this, but the way, as I understand it, a single contract is let by the Department of Health. That contract went to a company called Cognito for the last 2 years of training, and that's the training statistics that you're seeing today from their modular packet. I don't know whether Cognito would sell services individually to a district, but essentially what the state did was enter into a contract for that $265,000 amount with one provider, which provides the service then to all districts. I don't know if the option for individual, if the state didn't have such a program, I don't know if a individual district could buy hours of time from a company like Cognito or not for the training. Certainly staff development dollars can be used for other kinds of training, but this particular arrangement is a contract with one company to provide a service statewide.
Ms. Downey, since your agency was named, do you wish to weigh in?
Mr. Chair and representatives, Cognito does do individual contracts with a school or a district to purchase their health simulations.
Thank you. Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Downey, just a couple, and Representative Feist, I think this is a fine bill. I'm just looking, I want to make sure we've uncovered all the options. Ms. Downey, how many schools have actually used it? Have all the schools used the training?
Ms. Downey?
Yes, Mr. Chair and representatives, not all the schools or districts in the state have used the simulations as of yet. There are 75 schools and districts, and that's a combination of districts, private, and charter and tribal. So really there are some districts doing a rollout to their schools. So actually this number 75 is probably an underestimate of the number of total schools that are participating. So we continue to work to spread the word to encourage all districts to be able to add it to their professional development opportunities for staff.
Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if I look back at some previous history, I think that previous contract was $273,000, so this one's gone down a little bit for 2 years. That works out roughly to about $44 to $45 per school district. So two questions. How do we make sure all the schools are using it? And if they're not all using it, what are they using in lieu of this? Are they paying for other training, or is there other options out there?
Ms. Abderholden, Can you provide some insight there? I'm thinking about teacher licensure requirements fitting into this conversation.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. So a couple things. One is that the more schools you cover, the cheaper it is through Cognito. So when we did the kind of testing of it, schools could opt in, but they'd have to pay a whole lot more. So this made it very inexpensive for all the districts to participate. It is a requirement for teachers as part of their continuing education requirements to at least have 1 hour, and this often can go more than 1 hour, but this meets that criteria. The other thing that I want to mention is that this was being rolled out as the pandemic began. And so we had some districts that were just so focused on how do we move, you know, to, because it didn't roll out till last year, they just, I think, didn't have the bandwidth to actually participate. And so, you know, we're certainly hoping that this year, and with continued funding, that'll be easier for districts to participate. But again, anyone who has said that it really is an excellent training and really has helped them. I hope that answers the question.
Thank you. Representative Kreisha, any closing comment or question?
Yeah, just my closing. Yep, and thank you, Mr. Chair, and I want to be respectful of your time. So Representative Feist, again, I think this is fine. I'll vote yes for it. I see the cost benefit of buying a license at the state level for all the schools. What I would hope that the next time this comes back to us, that all the schools are using this, and I hope that we don't use the excuse that because of the pandemic or because of COVID, people are too busy. The executive order does give teachers an extra half an hour of prep time, and I would think that if the mental health is as serious as we're talking about, this should be a priority. So with that, thank you for the testimony, and thank you, Representative Feist, for bringing the bill forward. I'll vote yes.
Thank you, Representative Kreisha, and thank you for that. I would certainly hope that student mental health does not become a partisan issue in this committee or elsewhere. I'll stop there. Representative Feist, any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just like to emphasize that this is a really successful and novel suicide prevention training program, and that it is extremely timely and very, very important to our student body. And I'm excited that we're going to be having a conversation about evidence-based spending. And, you know, this is a program that we know works and is really important. And so I'm glad that I would encourage everyone to approve this extension of funding. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Feist. And with that, Representative Feist renews her motion to refer House File 486 as amended to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Ms. Sunderland, will you please take the roll?
Chair Dabney.
Chair votes aye.
Vice Chair Sandsted. Vice Chair Sandsted. Representative Kreisha.
Kreisha votes aye.
Representative Bennett.
Aye.
Representative Daniels.
Daniels votes aye.
Representative Damoth.
Damoth votes aye.
Representative Drazkowski.
No.
Representative Erickson.
Erickson votes aye.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Jordan.
Aye.
Representative Marquardt.
Marquardt votes aye.
Representative Mueller.
Mueller votes yes.
Representative Richardson.
Aye.
Representative Thompson.
Thompson, aye.
Representative Wolgamott.
Wolgamott, aye.
Representative Zhang.
Aye.
Representative Joachim.
Aye.
And Vice Chair Sandsted.
Sandsted votes aye.
Perfect. That is 16 ayes and 1 no.
Thank you, Ms. Sunderland. With that, the motion prevails. The bill is on its way to a committee with a long and complicated name, Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Representative Sandsted, thank you to the testifiers. Thank you very much for spending part of your day with us. With that, Representative Bennett, would you like to make a motion to move House File 1057 before the committee to lay it over for possible inclusion or for further consideration at a later date?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would. So I move to
hold House File 1057 over for possible inclusion in a future omnibus bill.
Thank you very much. Members of the committee and members of the public were looking to lay this bill over by approximately 11:20. So, Chair Representative Bennett, you may proceed with introducing your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, it's good to be with you and present this legislation to you, because this is actually intended as a tool in the toolbox for education committee members to help determine the effectiveness of the grant programs that we fund. And this would affect pre-K through 12 grant programs. Before I get into the details of the bill, I'd like to tell you why I'm doing this. And it's really birthed out of my experience as a classroom teacher. I think most of you know that I taught elementary school for 33 years, retired about 5 years ago. But I'd like to share with you what teachers do, what we as teachers do in our classroom. And I know those of you who are teachers on this committee know this well. I'll share this with you because it really flows into why I'm bringing this bill forward. So when a teacher is before a class, they identify issues or problems with their students. For example, you know, maybe a student is not achieving well in reading, or maybe they're not having appropriate interactions among their peers. So the teacher identifies a problem, then that teacher sets a goal. So let's say it's with reading, and they would say Johnny or Mary or whoever will read at grade level by the end of the school year. And then that teacher chooses a strategy or strategies to implement. The teacher collects data to determine if that strategy is working towards achieving the goal, and then that the instruction is based on what that data shows. And I feel like as education committee members, when we have grant programs come before us and ask for education funding, we should be doing something similar. So what my bill does is it would ask of the grant programs, and I'm making this very simple so it's not a huge paperwork nightmare. This has not had a fiscal note in the past. It's come before our committees. It's very simple. If a grant program is given funding, then at the end of their program or a particular time period, that the grant recipients must provide the following. They need to name an educationally related goal. They need to have a summary of the strategies they use to meet that goal and their data collection process, and a short report summarizing the data and the effectiveness of the strategies. And then that report would be submitted to both the minority and majority chairs of the education committees. There's really no set form for this. It's basically giving us as committee members the tools that we need to help us decide what we're funding. We all know we don't have an unlimited amount of funds that we deal with, and so we want to make sure that what we do fund is the most effective. And we also want to find out if there is a really effective program, let's multiply that throughout the state. And, you know, for example, the suicide training that we just heard as the last bill, if that's shown to be effective, then we should be repeating that throughout the state. It's a critical issue. So I'll just share with you that as I've sat on this committee and over a number of years, there are some programs that I've found to really have, they're already doing this, and a lot of the grant recipients are. For example, the Santa Foundation, I kind of just have this here, but they have noted that their data, and they listed here as decreased suspension rates and list that. Or another really good example is Reading Corps, which we have all had presented before us. They just give us a ton of data to support what they're doing, the goals that they have, and so on. So I just feel like this, I don't have a testifier because really I'm looking forward to hearing committee members' testimony on this and whether they feel this would be valuable or not. I know for me as a committee member, I want the best tools that I can to help me determine what I should be voting for and what I shouldn't be voting for. And we want to make sure that we're using tax dollars in a responsible way, an effective way. And I think this is just one tool in the toolbox for us to be able to do this. So I will be quiet now and just see if there's anybody who has any comments. And Mr. Chair, I really appreciate you hearing this bill again. I know you did previously and you've signed on to it previously, and I appreciate that. I just feel like it would be a great tool for all of us to use in the future as we determine what to fund for education.
Thank you, Representative. Yes, members, we included this bill 2 years ago in the House omnibus bill. Unfortunately, the Senate wasn't open to picking it up at that time. Maybe things will be different this year. We'll see. Any questions for Representative Bennett? Representative Bennett, I believe you get the speed record for today.
Well, that's a good record to have.
It is. Any closing comments then?
I see Representative Erickson has her hand up. Sorry to interrupt.
No, pardon me. Representative Erickson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Bennett, for this proposal. My question is for Mr. Strom. Do we have an approximate number of grants that or programs that provide grants through our education budget?
Mr. Strom?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, Ms. Adrians and I will put a count together for you. I don't have that offhand. There's been some years that have been very high on grants and other years not so much. So they do vary by year, but we'll put together a quick count for you and get back to you maybe even at this hearing. So.
Thank you very much.
Any other questions from members? Representative Bennett, Representative Erickson didn't slow you down that much. You still might get the speed record. Any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And she had a very good question, so I'll look forward to that information. Just want to say thank you again for hearing this. And it has been heard in the other body and committee already, so I'm hoping that it will move forward there as well. I'm excited about that. And I know, as I mentioned, there are programs already doing this, but there are some that don't. And I think this will also help those programs that aren't to have some structure, this loose structure, to be able to more focus more carefully on educational goals. And so I appreciate the committee's hearing this, and Mr. Chair, you too, and thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bennett. I noticed Representative Kreisha sliding into to home plate here. Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, what was the motion again on this bill?
The motion is to lay it over for possible inclusion.
Okay, very good. Thank you. To Representative Bennett, I noticed we had this last year in the omnibus bill and it got dropped in conference committee. Can you tell me why? Do you remember what happened?
Representative Bennett?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Well, basically what happened is it did not get heard in committee and in the other body, which I suppose I'm not supposed to mention. But what happened, really, it was going to be heard in that other body. But with the COVID restrictions that suddenly hit, I had met with the chair over there, and she was excited about it, willing to hear it. And then when the COVID restrictions hit, it really derailed a lot of bills. And unfortunately, this one got derailed in that body.
Representative Kreisha.
Okay. Thanks, Representative Bennett. I think it's a good bill.
Representative Joachim.
I just wanted to thank, sorry I didn't get on that list earlier. I just want to thank Representative Bennett for sticking with this bill. It was great when we heard it in 2019 and put it in our ed policy bill, and it's still good. I wish we could have gotten across the line in conference committee that year before COVID, but was having trouble getting the other body to understand what a good bill it was. So just thank you for being persistent.
All right. With that, unless Representative Bennett objects, I'm going to say that you renew your motion to lay House File 1057 over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Bennett. Members, we'll continue our conversation on evidence-based practices further today by hearing from the University of Minnesota Center for Applied Research and Educational Improvement. Dr. Gibbons, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Kim Gibbons, and I'm here from the University of Minnesota, the director of the Center for Applied Research and Educational Improvement.
Thank you. Please proceed.
All right. Let me go ahead and share my screen. There we go. Are you all able to see my screen?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. As I said, I'm the director of the Center for Applied Research and Educational Improvement at the University of Minnesota. I am also the co-director of the Wisconsin-Minnesota Comprehensive Center, which is one of 19 federally funded centers that provides technical assistance to state education agencies. So the Comp Center that I'm a part of is providing support to the SEAs of Wisconsin and Minnesota, so MDE, to really help build their capacity in scaling up evidence-based practices and then evaluating the impact of those practices. So we are just beginning our second year of work with the department. Today, I was asked to provide some information to you about the work of our center and to briefly discuss some big ideas around evidence-based practices as defined in the Every Student Succeeds Act, ESSA, and some of the challenges of implementing programs, practices, and policies that are evidence-based. I'll end with some recommendations for your committee to consider as you consider funding programs and practices through grants. So quick introduction to CARI. CARI is a soft money research center. And what that means is that we really don't get any funding from the university. We're responsible for generating our own revenue to keep the center open. So we've been around for 31 years, and we like to think that we serve as the link between research and practice in school districts and other agencies who are interested in implementing evidence-based practices. What we do is we partner with school districts and other agencies and really help them apply the research on educational practices.
Oh, Ms. Gibbons, you've just frozen just a bit. You may want to turn off your...
As I said before, we're funded primarily through grants, external sales projects with school districts and nonprofits, and other technical assistance projects. So mission is to improve the quality of education for all learners, thereby society as a whole. And so we really work in partnership. We try not to come at our partnerships with we're from the University of Minnesota and we know all the answers. We're really there to partner with districts and to figure out what works under what conditions to help districts implement programs and practices with fidelity, to evaluate the impact of those programs. And we're really focusing in on an emphasis on helping to close the achievement gap. So our vision is that we would like to sort of be the network hub to help build educators' database decision-making capacity. And we do that in four different ways. Beginning this summer, we will have a research arm at CARI where we will really be focused on high quality research to test hypotheses using rigorous methods. We are also engaged in professional learning opportunities with districts from around the state, focusing on things like the multi-tiered system of support framework, evidence-based practices, problem of practice groups or networked improvement communities. And we're really trying to hone in on the area of data literacy to help educators understand all of the different types of assessments that are currently in their arsenal and why, what questions those different assessments will answer and won't answer. We do technical assistance with our partners, and we've also engaged in rigorous program evaluation. So we're really trying to help with program eval, helping districts understand, is what we're doing, is it better, is it worse, or is it the same as before? How can we improve implementation? Are we implementing solutions with fidelity, and are we closing the gap fast enough? So the Every Student Succeeds Act is really kind of the driving force. And, you know, just to the big idea around that is that we want to have equitably designed education systems to ensure that students who have historically been underserved receive an education that prepares them for the 21st century demands. So the big components of ESSA are, first of all, having a high quality curriculum and assessments available to teachers, multiple measures to assess schools, including, you know, having a dashboard of different indicators that we know is predictive of success, but also looking beyond test scores and graduation, making sure that we are addressing resource inequities and providing incentives for strategies that are linked to student needs. And then finally, having evidence-based instruction and programs that are engaging and safe and really promote a culture of collaboration. So I think, you know, put really simply, what we're trying to do is to figure out what works for whom and under what set of conditions. And so when we look at evidence-based practices in law, I'm sure that you're aware that there's different definitions when we unpack things. The strongest evidence is when there is at least one well-designed and well-implemented experimental study. And the typical term that we use is a randomized control study, where we are randomly assigning to a treatment condition and a control condition so that we can start to infer for causation between the practice and the outcomes that are attained. Moderate is at least one well-designed and well-implemented quasi-experimental study, so no random assignment, but matching, using a matching process. And then there's promising practice, which is at least one well-designed and well-implemented correlational study with statistical controls for selection bias. So correlation is not causation. We just know that two things are associated. So I think the dilemma right now in education is that we, when we're trying to select an evidence-based practice, we have to first of all look at what's the best available research evidence that's out there of whatever practice it is that we're interested in looking at. Then we need to have educators look at their own student characteristics, their geography, their values, their preferences. And then districts have to have resources to actually implement those practices. So that includes professional learning, so that our educators have expertise in implementing that evidence-based practice. And then we really have to look at the overlap between the best research, our resources, and our student characteristics. And that is what really should be informing the decision to select whatever it is that we're doing. So if we really think about ESSA and evidence-based practices as a roadmap to closing the achievement gap, I think the things that are really going to enable us to drive down that road is we have to be able to use data to identify student needs. We have to implement evidence-based instruction and interventions with fidelity, and then we need to evaluate the impact. And I think when we think about challenges to implementation of evidence-based practices, there are a few of them. And I think the first example that I'll give to you is one that I see happen all the time in Minnesota and around the country, and it's referred to as solutionitis. And what that means is that school districts, people jump really quickly on trying to figure out a solution before they really have a clear understanding of the problem and what those root causes are of the problem. And then you see popular ideas moving really quickly around the educational landscape. Each of those ideas becomes the new hammer to, you know, try to solve the problem. And a lot of times those popular ideas lack a research base. So districts don't get the outcomes that they were expecting, and then they jump on, you know, to the next solution that's coming down the pike. So the challenges with implementing evidence-based practice, first of all, is that there's a research to practice gap. It typically takes about 17 to 20 years for research to actually make its way into practice. So I was in graduate school in 1990, I finished in 1995, and I'm just seeing now, like almost 30 years later, a lot of the things that were identified through research actually making their way into practice. I think that it becomes really hard for school districts sometimes to give up what they have done well, even if it's no longer relevant with the population of students today. And I think that it's very important to evaluate the impact of what we do. And what we know is that program evaluation isn't happening all that often. So I've put a link to a statewide needs assessment that our center did about 5 years ago. And we had over 1,000 responses from across the state. And we found through that needs assessment that 51% of administrators in Minnesota rated their capacity to evaluate policies and programs as poor. And the reason that high quality evaluation wasn't happening, it was lack of time, not having adequate staffing in the district and expertise around evaluation, research methodologies, measurement, assessment, and the cost of doing program evaluation. Other roadblocks that were identified is that nearly everyone that we surveyed said that they think that quality data could improve educational decisions, but 70% of respondents said that their capacity to effectively use data to guide decisions was fair to poor. So, and lots of respondents indicated that they have a lot of data available. So they said that, you know, that phrase data rich, but information poor, because not everyone understands how to use all of the different types of data to make good decisions for students. So I was really intrigued. And when I saw the bill that Representative Bennett was putting forward, because this has actually been something that our center has been advocating for, that we really think whenever there's an investment that's made through a grant or an allocation, that there should be a portion of that grant funding should be required to set aside to evaluate the impact of programs, practices, and policies. I'm not here to say that money should be set aside for our center to do that. We certainly could help, but there's lots of different avenues that districts can go down in terms of getting evaluation expertise. I think it's also important that evaluators are trained in research methodology, statistics, and measurement. So really, you know, having someone that has, you know, a master's or a PhD that can really help set up the goals that districts are trying to reach by implementing a particular practice, how they're going to measure that, what they think the intended outcomes should be. Also having a logic model that has a clearly defined research or evaluation questions. So this is just an example of a logic model, and it's just a snapshot where you would identify resources and activities that are needed to implement whatever practice or program you're going to implement. And then you're looking to see what are the outputs, what are the short-term and long-term outcomes that you're expecting, and how are you going to evaluate those outcomes? So I think just to wrap up too, along with a logic model, having a detailed implementation plan that has a timeline, how you're going to analyze your data, how you're going to disseminate it, and, you know, most importantly, really think about requiring that we measure whether the program or practice that we're implementing is actually being implemented the way that it was. So I will stop right there, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have. I know I went through that really quickly, but I was told to try to stick within 15 minutes, so hopefully I did that.
You did great, Dr. Givens, and thank you for it. And you'll be glad to know that this committee 2 years ago, when we looked at organizations that wished to receive grant funding, while we did not do a full-on grant application with the logic model and all of that, we did set up a structure where they had to provide us with, you know, what's your research base? What's your plan? Something more that was new to this committee's operations, but we wanted to put some rigor around who was asking us for money and what they were going to do with that money if they received it. So
that's great.
We heard you. Apparently our ears were burning a little bit, and we heard you 2 years ago. We've got a number of members with questions. Let's start with Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Givens, for your presentation. Can you tell us if you're able to, is there a particular school district or districts with whom you're working and how you use the data and how you get the data, and then what results after you get the data if it's for a particular evaluation of a program? I just need to hear something more specific so I understand where we're trying to go. Thank you.
Dr. Givens.
Thank you. Thank you for your question, Representative Erickson. Yes, we are currently working with a number of school districts. One of the frameworks that has a very strong evidence base is a multi-tiered system of support framework, MTSS. Those of you that have been around for several years, you've probably seen me before testifying about this. But in the work that we're doing with districts in Minnesota right now, and specifically we're working we're just beginning work with the Minnetonka School District. We've worked with Prior Lake Savage. We've worked with Sartell St. Stephens. We've worked with Anoka Hennepin. I can provide you a long list of folks we've worked with. But what we do is we go in and we collect information and data on their implementation of the framework, and we use a variety of different data sources, and then we come back and we work with them to figure out what's working really well with implementation and where some barriers or opportunities to actually implement the framework with fidelity. So in some of the districts that we worked with, we've been focused, we've found findings that there's been very low reading growth in the early grade levels in K-1 and 2, and we've been able to identify and help them figure out how they're setting appropriate goals with the data measures that they're using and setting ambitious enough goals that will predict proficiency on the MCAs when they take those in the third grade. And then we also help them kind of unpack their curriculum and their instruction and assessment. So we partner with them. We don't come in and say, here's your 3-year plan of all the things that you need to do. We work with the district leaders and the teachers to really prioritize the recommendations that come out of our study. And then we help them develop an implementation plan with measurable goals. And if they want us to, we will provide technical assistance and coaching over a few years. We did that with the Sartell St. Stephens School District for 3 years. So that we're just really trying to work in a continuous improvement framework and really help districts get better at getting better and really trying to directly tackle some of the achievement gaps that we're seeing across the state. Did that answer your question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Ms. Gibbons, do you have data agreements since you're accessing data that's protected? Do you have agreements with those districts?
Dr. Gibbons?
Yes, we do. We go through a contracting process between the university office and the school districts. And then any data that we we receive is de-identified and stored in a secure platform.
So let's, thank you, Mr. Chair. So let's think about one of the districts you mentioned. I think you said Sartell, St. Stephen. So have you looked at the results then of your interaction in regard to collecting the data, giving them feedback, and has there been progress made, for example, if they had low reading growth or whatever area it might be? Could you comment on that, please?
Dr. Gibbons?
Sure, yes, I can. So we concluded our work with Sartell St. Stephen's last summer. We worked with them for 3 years. And one of the things that we worked on was their infrastructure. They did not have a district level implementation team. They didn't have building teams. So we really, as I said, we unpacked the findings of the study and really started to focus on what's the infrastructure that we have to get in place. And so we worked with their data coordinator on making sure that the right assessment measures were being administered, that they had good decision rules. We helped them set up a district team. I would come in and help them lead that district team and then gradually released my involvement. So at the end of our 3 years together, what we had was really good information in terms of helping to make sure that we had collaborative teams in place to really guide those instructional decisions, drilling down to the grade level. We helped them. They were right at the process of identifying supplemental phonics programs to push into their early grade level instruction, and we're investigating math interventions as well. So I would have to go back to them at this point now and say, our contract is ended, but go back and look to see what their data is looking like today.
And Mr. Chair, one last question.
Yes, Representative Erickson, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Ms. Gibbons, what is the cost to a district to do this analysis and this guidance, for example, with Sartell's St. Stephen's? Yeah.
Dr. Gibbons?
Thank you.
In a change to infrastructure.
Yeah, it really depends on the size of the district, because what we like to do is we go out and we interview building teams in every building. So obviously the larger the district, the more buildings we have to cover. But I would say it usually ranges between, I think the most inexpensive one we did was maybe $10,000, probably up to about $25,000 for the actual study. And then if districts want technical assistance, that's usually depending on how we set it up, what they actually want. You know, it can be anywhere from $7,000 a year to $20,000 a year.
Mr. Chair, I do have one last question.
Very briefly, Representative Erickson.
Yes, well, my question is, does this not conflict then what we've asked MDE to do through our regional centers of excellence? It seems to me that that's one of the obligations we gave them, and you don't necessarily have to answer. I just want to raise that because it seems to me the legislature did, really work to get MDE to begin these interactions with districts, and this data, understanding how to use data, et cetera, was one of the goals. But thank you, Mr. Chair.
Dr. Gibbons, do you conflict with or complement MDE?
Oh, I think we complement MDE. I think what I've, my experience with school districts has been that the regional centers of excellence are working primarily with districts that are on the list of needing improvement. And we have a lot of districts that aren't on that list, but they still want to get better at getting better. And so we have primarily been working with those, with districts that are not on the needs improvement list, but certainly have needs that they want to address.
Thank you. Representative Thompson, your question.
Thank you, Chair, Ms. Gibbons. I waited a few minutes. I wanted to ask this question. We talk about research, data, evidence-based practices. We talked about standardized testing. I'm listening very closely. I know you talk about standardized testing. My kids bomb at standardized testing, by the way. They fail every time they take it, so I stopped letting them take it because both of my kids been on the honor roll for the past 4 years. So I always wonder who are you evaluating? And then it was disheartening to hear you said data gathered 30 years ago is now being used, and here I am thinking we're thinking outside of the box, and we're using stuff that you – so we all do know who's at the top of the list when it comes to the achievement gap is African-American kids that look just like my kids. How does data top lived experiences, and how much of these community input – do they even listen to the voices or take some of those voices into consideration – when gathering this data? Because it seems like no matter how much, like I guess I'll be blunt and say that we don't need another study group. We need a group to go to work on trying to fix the achievement gap. And we know why. We don't have culturally competent. We don't have enough culturally competent teachers and administrators in all of our districts. You know, and a lot of times these decisions are made for us without us at the table, and the outcome doesn't help. Thus, my kids are on the honor roll, and standardized testing is not working for them at all. As a matter of fact, they have anxiety when that test comes around. I just told them they don't even have to take this test anymore. This is my lived experience. They're sizing our kids up for these jumpsuits in sixth grade. Pipeline to prison is real. This is data that I've gathered because I've been I'm a professional. I've been professionally black for the past 40 years, and the black community is suffering, you know, and when it comes to education. And so when I hear people say, we're going to do another study, we're going to gather some more data, and then I hear you say, well, this is stuff we found out 30 years ago. 30 years ago, I was in school. And so I just wanted to just pick your brain a little bit on that, those two questions. There was a question in there, too.
Dr. Gibbons, lots to chew on there.
Yes, and thank you for your comments. I am in complete agreement. I know that the work that we're trying to do as an organization right now, we're really trying to increase our own awareness of anti-racism policies and practices. We're infusing when we go out and do some of these. You know, I'm calling it a study, but it's really it's data gathering to identify problems. So, you know, for example, we are disaggregating data for districts, not only for achievement data, you know, by subgroups, but also for things like discipline and attendance. And we have uncovered some real disparities, particularly with Black students and discipline and amount of time out of school. All that to say, what could you remind me, like you said a lot, but what was your specific question that about the fact that 30 years later and all the research is just making its way into practice?
Yes, that's
Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Chair. Ms. Gibbons, I said I noticed that, and I was just writing it down, you said that data, you finally see data that was gathered 30 years ago now being implemented. So a lot of the money that the district say we don't have is being spent on gathering data. Is that and it's not being implemented. I'm trying to understand that part. But I know our kids don't need another working group, or we need a group to go to work. We don't need another study, because you know, we've been studied for as long as I've been in the state. You know, it's actually time to start implementing a lot of the things that you've already gathered. And I don't know if that's something that you, but at some point, those community voices that you hear, because I know a lot of them, I hear a lot of them, those community voices are their lived experience is more valuable than any data you can gather. And if you implement their lived experience and the things that they want to see, I'm quite sure that we wouldn't have this huge achievement gap. Or is it still a beating? because African Americans used to get beat. Now they call it an achievement gap, is what I'm saying. So what I'm asking you is, the data that was gathered 30 years ago, you said is now being implemented now. Why is that?
Dr. Gibbons?
Yes. So what I was saying is, it's the research that is conducted that shows what's effective. There's a gap between when that research actually makes its way into practice. So for example, I am big on the literacy bandwagon right now. And the science of reading has been settled since about the year 2000. And yet we have a majority of our districts using practices to teach students how to read that aren't validated by research. So we've got lots and lots of kids, including African-American kids, that aren't a lot. Many of the programs used in Minnesota, for example, in kindergarten and first grade, don't include systematic and explicit instruction on phonics and phonemic awareness. If we could get that type of instruction in place, I guarantee you we're going to start to see a shrinkage of the achievement gap. It's very frustrating. I know that MDE right now has a professional development program called Letters, LTRS. You might be familiar with that they're trying to push out, because this is all about increasing teachers' knowledge of, they're not really getting it in higher ed. They're not learning the science of reading. So we need to increase their knowledge so that they can actually evaluate the curriculum tools that are in front of them and know where the gaps are and know how to fill in those gaps. So.
Representative Thompson?
No other questions, Chair. Thank you so much, Ms. Gibbons and Chair.
Representative Kreshaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a clarification for the record, Representative Thompson, I heard you make a reference to beating kids, and I wanted to just give you a chance to respond and see how that relates to the academic conversation we're having here. Maybe that just was an offhanded comment, but I just wanted to give you a chance to clear the record on what you meant when you threw that in.
Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Chair, and Representative Kreshaw. Representative Kreshaw, I choose my words very carefully so I know exactly what I say and I can repeat them. I said, is it still a beating? Because our ancestors used to get beat if they were caught learning, and now we call it an achievement gap. The same thing about beating kids. But our kids are getting the same beating because we call it an achievement gap right now. Our kids are being sized up for jumpsuits. The pipeline to prison is real, thus beating. My kids are being taught by culturally incompetent teachers and administrators. There's always a room when I walk into the schools and I go into the Black history class and there's a white woman teaching Black history, I find that there's a disconnect. So when you ask me about the beating, I'm saying that ancestors, my ancestors, if you watch Alex Haley Roots, you would also see that also. Our ancestors were beat if they were caught reading and writing. They were hung up by a tree and beat. And so that's what I mean. And now here we are in 2021, and it's not a beating anymore. It's just the name has changed. They call it an achievement gap. So I thank you for the question, but I wanted to clarify our lived experience to you also, because I know also that just because our lived experience isn't someone else's doesn't necessarily mean it's not true.
Representative Kreshaw. Thank you, Representative Thompson.
Thank you for the clarification, and I appreciate that, and I just want to call it out just to make sure I understood your point. As we know, beatings and child abuse is very real amongst all of our kids, and I just want to make sure that wasn't inadvertently tossed in. So thank you for your clarification.
And Representative Kreshaw, we know you've done a lot of work in the area of child welfare and child abuse, so thank you for asking that clarification and allowing Representative Thompson to remind us of the history. And the current status. Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to thank you for having Dr. Gibson here to
walk us through some of the evidence-based research. And for mentioning MTSS, it just shows that having a framework that actually has that ability to go back and analyze built in really does help further things. And I found your study interesting that you said most administrators say that it's the time that they don't have, and the teachers say that they don't have the expertise to look at the data. And I think those are kind of two different conversations we could have with the administrators not having the time or the money to do that, the deep dive into the data. I think we forget about that when we do grant programs, and then we try to really cap the administrative cost very small, because part of that administrative cost is then evaluating the program like we're asking them to evaluate. So I want us to kind of keep that in mind when we start talking about administrative costs as well. But my question would kind of be going towards looking at what do we do to help teachers, or what would you suggest we do to help in that teacher education piece of it to make sure they understand how to look at the data and analyze what they're teaching and what they're implementing as well. I know some schools like St. Paul's done a really good job of setting time aside for teachers to work in cohorts to do deep dive in data. But unless you happen to have a teacher on staff that has a master's in public policy or public analysis and looking at the data, it can be really a difficult process to do it accurately. So just wondering any suggestions you might have around that and how we can either beef up our teacher program in that aspect, or what we can do to make sure our administrators have access to the tools to look at the programs. Because we don't want, you know, five programs on the books doing the same thing when one really good program could do, and they just don't have the time to spend or the money or the staffing to call through those programs and really be more efficient.
Dr. Gibbons.
Thank you. So when I said that, expertise like a master's or a PhD, really that's getting at more rigorous evaluation efforts, like at the district or, the building level. But what you raised is how do we get teachers to really understand the different sources of data and how to use those data to guide their decision-making. So I spent 20 years as a school administrator prior to coming to the university. I've been here 6 years. And the work that we did was you really have to make it job embedded. And it really starts with getting collaborative time in place for teachers to work collectively together, so that it's not this view that I'm a teacher with 25 kids and these are my kids. And that we want to embrace that notion. These are all of our kids belong to us. And so really helping to unpack it with teachers, a lot of teachers think that the MCAs are going to tell them what to do and what to teach in the classroom. And they're not designed to do that. So that's a data literacy problem. If people think that the MCAs are going to tell them what to do in the classroom tomorrow with a student, we've got lots of districts that use the NWA MAP, Measures of Academic Progress, which is good for looking at growth from fall to spring. But lots of people think that that's progress monitoring, and giving a student a measure in the fall and the spring is we can look at their growth, but it's not a progress monitoring tool that you could use daily or weekly with students. So it's really, I think, that job-embedded professional development, having a facilitator of those meetings that's trained, that has support to help work with their team about all of the data sources and what they mean and what they don't mean. So, I've been a huge fan of curriculum-based measures like, AIMS-Webb or Dibbles or FastBridge. Those are short, little, easy measures that predict really well to the Minnesota Comprehensive Assessments. And it doesn't take a lot of time to teach folks about the appropriate uses of those measures and how they can help guide instruction.
Representative Joachim?
No, thank you. That's very, very helpful. And I think we do forget that MCAs are something that they don't get until much later. It is a different measure. We have to look at what tool we're using and what we're trying to measure to see
instead of having one thing be all. So I really do appreciate that.
Thank you, Representative Joaquin. Dr. Gibbons, thank you so much. You've given us a great deal to think about and chew on as we as our work moves forward. Thank you for your work and your team's work at CARI, and thank you for your time today.
Thank you so much for inviting me. Feel free to follow up if there's any other questions I can answer offline.
Fabulous. Thank you so much. With that, members, our work here today is completed, and we are adjourned. Have a good rest of your day. Thank you.